I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are back with another roundtable, and this show is brought to you by you. It's brought to you by the donations of those among you who want to give and keep us going, keep the lights on, keep the signal going out. And there's a way of doing that if you use credit cards, and that is to go to entropystream.live/countercurrents. Once you go there, you will find that it says we're offline. That's simply because we're not streaming right now through Entropy. We're going through DLive and Odyssey. But you can hit the green button and leave a paid chat anyway, an offline chat, and we will read it and comment on it in the course of the show. And of course, thank you for your support. So I also want to put up the, as a ticker tape across the bottom, how you can follow our two guests, or the other two members of the Brain Trust. And that would be Millennial Woes, first of all. Woes, welcome back.
Hello. Hello, Greg, and hello, everyone else.
And also Frody Midyard. Frody, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for that. And it's good to be back. I'm looking forward to the questions.
Well, before we go into the questions, though, I want you to promote yourself. Promote your upcoming debate, which will be in less than 1 week. So can you tell us about the great debate that's coming up?
Absolutely. And thank you for the opportunity. So next Saturday, that is Saturday the 21st at 4 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time, which is 10 p.m. Central European Time, there will be the great debate between Jared Taylor and E. Michael Jones. And they will be debating the topic, is race a fiction or an important reality? And this is because E. Michael Jones has said repeatedly that there's no such thing as race, that the white race doesn't exist, that race is a fiction, and that it has, that there is no hereditary impact on performance between different populations that we call races. Of course, Jared Taylor has, for an entire career, for 25, 30 years, argued the opposite. And he is one of the best known persons out there talking about racial issues, especially in America. So they will be debating this topic. It was supposed to happen 1.5 years ago in May of 2020 in Zagreb, Croatia, for the Skanza Forum. But because of the corona crisis, travel hasn't been possible in a normal way, so we had to postpone the conference, and I was hoping that we were going to be able to do it this year instead, but since the travel restrictions look like they will be continuing, I decided to organize this as an online live debate, and the good news is, of course, that everyone is invited, so everyone listening to this will be able to follow the debate live. It will be live streamed on Guide to Culture, on DLive and on Odyssey. And I think Countercurrents DLive will be hosting it as well. And hopefully as many other live streamers on DLive as possible will be hosting it as well, because that's a way to boost the reach of this live stream and debate so that as many people as possible can watch it. So this will be a huge thing, and a lot of people have been excited about it, and people have been talking about it since I announced it in January of 2020, right before the whole COVID madness happened. So I'm super excited about this. Jared and Jones are also very excited about it. They were, of course, hoping to be able to face off in person in Zagreb, but because of the current situation, we had to postpone the live event. So when things will be possible again, when events will be possible again and travel will be possible again, we'll definitely do a live conference and invite both guests, because I know a lot of people have been looking forward to meeting them in person as well. But now we're going to do this debate live. And another good thing is that everyone can participate in the Q&A. So we'll have a Q&A afterwards, and we'll be taking questions through Entropy, and that's entropystream.live/GTK for Guide to Culture. And that way you can send in your questions and comments and participate in this great event. So hopefully everyone will join me next Saturday the 21st at 4 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
Wonderful. That sounds great. Folks, if you have a DLive channel, if you know streamers out there who do, get in touch with them. Put them in touch with Frody. Let's make sure that this thing is omnipresent. And if you are planning to do a stream at the same time, don't. You're going to want to listen in. Your stream should be postponed, because this is something that we should all be behind and we should all be listening to and taking part in, because it's important. It's epical. And it could be the beginning of many such important debates. I hope that it will be just the first of many such discussions. So I have to apologize to a couple people from last week. We ran out of time. And I want to first go to a couple of comments from Unknown Californian. He sent $80, and I'm just going to read these comments and thank him very much. What black pills me is this bit from George Carlin. There's a reason education sucks, and it's the same reason that it will never be fixed, because the owners of this country don't want that. I'm talking about the real owners now, the big wealthy business interests that control things and make all the important decisions. You have no choice. You have owners. They own you. They own everything. They own all the important land. They own all and control the corporations. They've long since bought and paid for the Senate, the Congress, the state houses, the city halls, and they got the judges in their back pockets and own all the big media companies. So they control just about all of the news and information you get to hear. They've got you by the balls. They got you by the brains, folks. They spend billions of dollars every year lobbying to get what they want. Well, we know what they want. They want more for themselves and less for everybody else, but I'll tell you what they don't want. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interests. They want obedient workers who are just dumb enough to passively accept all these increasingly shittier jobs and the lower pay and the longer hours and the reduced, just one second, I need to flip one page forward here. Reduced benefits, the end of overtime, and the vanishing pension that disappears the minute you go to collect it. It's a big club and you ain't in it. You and I are not in the big club. They don't care about you at all, and nobody seems to notice. Nobody seems to care. That's what the owners count on. Yeah, I have to agree with this. And they don't just want us to accept less. They're replacing us with people who will be glad to have less. They're replacing us with grateful peasants. That's one of the reasons why race replacement immigration happens. That's the Republican version of race replacement. The Democrat version is entirely more sinister. The Republicans just go along with it because they're greedy and stupid. But they want to replace white workers with grateful peasants. Their image of the future is not a high-tech economy with highly paid workers. It is a low-tech economy with starving, basically peasants. But you know, you can be very, very rich and powerful in a low-tech, quasi-feudal society, and that is the most evil form of Anglo-Saxon capitalism: the plantation economy, the low-tech plantation economy. That's what they're trying to create here in America, as opposed to the high-tech economy. I said it all. I said it's evil. There's no other word for it. So anyway, you sent almost $100. Thank you. $95. I appreciate that. So I wanted to get your comment in. And I want to run through a couple other folks who sent in comments. I don't know, bro. I don't know. Sent in 10 Great Britain pounds and said, thanks for the show. C sends in $3. Quigley sends in $20. What are your thoughts about the COVID-19 vaccine and vaccine mandates? We'll get to that. Steve sent in $100. Very generous. Mr. James sends in $50 and says, thank you. Well, thank you right back. Kobayashi, I think that's the correct pronunciation, wanted me to ask last week about basically COVID stuff too. Okay. Public sentiment is overwhelmingly against mass immigration and coronavirus restrictions, yet we're seemingly powerless to prevent them being enforced. Why? Not a very well thought out question, but essentially what I'm going through right now. Well, the short answer is that what we call liberal democracy. And it's very interesting. Even conservatives piously always stress that they stand for liberal democracy. What does liberal democracy really mean? Liberal democracy means, in theory, the rights of the individual, that the masses can't gang up on the individual and squelch their speech and their private freedoms and things like that, even if it's very popular. But what liberal democracy in practice means is minority rule, because some minorities have veto power and other minorities don't. And they veto the majority, and they have basically made a science of not giving the people what they want. So yeah, mass immigration is phenomenally unpopular. It would never be passed. Economic globalization, the hollowing out of Western industries and economies, is very unpopular. It never would have passed. And yet we have it. And we also have the corona stuff. We have it because we have a system that makes a science. We have a democracy that makes a science of not giving the people what they want. Populism is a dirty word in the mouths of liberal Democrats because populism is the thing that they fear the most, meaning they have to give the people what they want. So anyway, I thought that was a pretty good question. So anyway, I want to talk about a question that I got from LC. I assume that that's our favorite cat. LC has three questions this week. And the first question is, what do we think of Gregory Hood's article on should people trust the science? And maybe somebody can share that in the chat. I thought it was a great article, and I want to just, you know, discuss the article itself and also the themes in it with the panel. And people have also sent in some questions that are related to it. So should we trust the science? Well, I want to just start with one thing. The whole idea of reason is to eliminate, if you will, faith, right? It's faith versus reason. And telling people you need to trust the science is almost a contradiction in terms, because it's basically saying you have to have faith in reason. You have to have faith in scientific experts. And that is problematic just on its face. But then the other thing is that you're basically not asking people to have trust in a process of science, which you can lay out in ideal terms as a self-critical, self-correcting process of getting to the truth. That's the ultimate arbiter is reality. And false theories are eliminated through rigorous testing. Okay, that's science in theory. But when you're asking people to trust science, you're not asking people to engage in science. You're not asking people to engage in scientific investigation. You're asking them to trust people who have scientific credentials, who wear lab coats, who are experts. Who proclaims them experts? Not you. They're proclaimed experts by other people that you're supposed to trust. And so we get into the whole issue of social trust. And the main reason why a lot of people are loath to trust the experts, and this is especially true in the case of COVID, is that the experts obviously lie all the time. And Greg Hood makes the point that the experts are openly declare that they either don't think that race is real, or they will actually claim, like Daniel Dennett, who's a philosopher, that if race were real, he would hide that fact from people. Okay, these are the people we're supposed to trust. These are the people who will hide reality in order to forward a political agenda. These are the people who claim that transsexuals are real men or real women, just as real as the ones who are born that way. These are the people who defend the science of giving hormone blockers to children. This is science, folks. You got to trust the science. These are people who claim that we need to give enormous amounts of unaccountable power to various experts because of something called climate change. They used to call it global warming, but they decided to rename it climate change because, well, that's unfalsifiable because the climate's always changing. And so they can always say, whether it's colder or warmer than average, that there's something wrong and that they need a great deal of power to fix it. And that basically Western economies need to cripple themselves, which will make the Chinese very, very happy. So climate change is fake science. It's obviously a power grab. It's a form of gaslighting Western societies into crippling themselves without in any way suppressing third world fertility, third world fossil fuel use, or anything like that. So this is there's plenty of reason, I think, not to trust scientists, not to trust experts, and not to trust the people who claim to be experts in the media. The media is the main organ telling us we need to trust the science, and the media is one of the least trusted institutions in Western societies. So it's very reasonable for people to be skeptical. Those are my initial thoughts. Woz, I know you're skeptical about a lot of this stuff. What are your thoughts?
Oh, well, I wrote down some notes about this, and so I'll just read them. I think this idea of trust the science, this is an important point. There is no such thing as the science. The science does not exist as a sort of corporate entity. It's not some singular thing or a system. What it is many people using scientific methods and having scientific knowledge, but they might use those methods in a flawed way, in a biased way, in a corrupt way. They might feed certain data that they know will get a certain result into a scientific process. It's very much subject to human bias and corruption. So this is the problem with the very question, should we trust the science? There is no the science. It does not exist. But I think it's interesting because I think we speak of science now as in two different ways that are both delusional. The first is we speak of science as a sort of machine that is infallible and purely rational. It doesn't make mistakes. It is not biased. It is pure truth. It is pure, an infallible system for finding the truth. And so whatever the science tells us must be true. That's one way, that's sort of a machine. And then the other way we speak of science is in more religious tones, as a god or as an oracle, something that we consult. So I've seen people say, and I've seen children say, the science tells us X, Y, or Z. The science tells us this. Science has explained this. Science recommends this. Now, that's like something that the oracle told us. The oracle explained this for us. The oracle has, we consulted the oracle, we visited, and we venerate this thing, and in return it is good to us. Now, that's how people are starting to speak about science. And I think what's happened is that in the absence of organized religion, we've been given by the elites a new organized religion. I think it is effectively an organized religion at this point. Now, that's not to say that I think it's just a load of hogwash. I don't. But I think it has now taken the place of the church. And that's a very interesting situation. But it's very scary as well, because it's a thing that you can't argue. The layman cannot argue with the experts. And, you see this whenever someone like a COVID denier somehow gets onto TV. What the presenter will always say to them is, so you think you know better than all of these scientists? You think, what gives you, what are your qualifications? Why do you, what makes you think that you could possibly know better than them? And so that's not just condescending. It is also a sort of logical thing to say. It is condescending, but it's also kind of logical. It makes sense that, well, what can the layman possibly, how can he possibly know better than this expert who's highly trained? Well, the fact is that he can, because the expert can be corrupt. I mean, I've actually had a conversation with, not an expert exactly, but someone doing a biology degree, who's told me that there is no such thing as race. And he was using his biology degree as a, I forgot what the term is, appeal to authority. That, well, I don't have a biology degree, and I've never studied for one, but he is studying for one. So obviously he must know more about this than I do. And by knowing more about this than I do, he must be closer to the truth than I am. Almost in a linear fashion, like the more knowledge you have, the closer you must be to understanding. There is not a linear relationship between, or a proportional relationship between knowledge and understanding. That's another fallacy that we could talk about. But either way, the point is that it's very possible for science to be corrupt and dishonest. And what we have now, anyone who knows about Bill Gates, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, among other organizations, is that they are funding, they're funneling massive, massive amounts of money into scientific research, into their own bodies, their own organizations, and to, into other organizations, which are then indebted to them, and will then, you know, the will then do their bidding. He who pays the piper. And I think that we always, certainly in my early life, my childhood, adolescence, in the 90s, the 80s, the 70s, there was a certain assumption that science is, yes, of course there are bad apples, but it's a system that works. And yes, there was that thalidomide thing. We all know about that. But by and large, it's truth finding. There is integrity. There is moral probity. And there is tremendous care and professionalism that goes into this research work. But I just don't believe that anymore, because as you mentioned, Greg, we've heard about global warming, the ozone layer, global cooling, now climate change, even other things like climate apocalypse, climate refugees, etc., which doesn't seem to, and it's extremely easy, and you can see that it's extremely easy to corrupt, to come up with the findings that your funders want you to come up with. That's climate change. Then there's race. Then there's even now male and female, sex, gender. That apparently is now an illusion. This is the world that we now live in. And so if they tell me that a disease with a 99.6% survival rate, even with their massage statistics, is a real dangerous thing that we should all be very worried about, I'm not inclined to believe them. It gets to this point where you have to actually, the right thing to do when the learned man is telling you something that is so contrary to your own experience, it gets to the point where it might well be the thing the right thing to do to ignore him. And the opposite side of that argument would be your own lived experience is that the earth is flat, but you believe the science, the scientists who tell you that the earth is round. But if you were to go by your own experience, you'd think it was flat. So you're obviously making a decision to ignore, to quite totally suppress your own lived experience of stuff and believe this thing that is actually quite a strange thing. This is quite a strange concept that the earth is actually round and there's this thing called gravity that holds it all together. You're making that decision. And in the same way, I think we're now in this situation where what they're, but it's a different thing here, because what they're telling us is very different from our lived experience. I don't know anyone who has died from COVID-19. I don't know anyone who's been seriously ill with it. And yet they're telling us that it's something to be very scared about. And I've made the decision long ago, I think it was May last year or April last year, that something is amiss here. Something is very amiss here. So, no, I don't trust the science. And to answer the question, should we trust the science? I think the answer is no. Now, that doesn't mean that we should always not trust it. But in a case like this, where there is such a disparity between what you see and what you're being told, I think you have to make a decision about that. And that would be my decision.
One thing that I wrote a few years back that I'm very proud of is a piece on this ludicrous in the literal sense. It's laughable. It's a laughable idea that race is a social construct. I just linked it in the chat at DLive. Race is not a social construct. And the people who want to argue that it's a social construct, they're basically asking you not to trust your lying eyes. And it's a flim-flam. When people try and do that, I see differences, radical differences between African pygmies and white people. And you're saying that that's not a real difference. It's merely notional. And it's therefore essentially illusory and something that can be just ignored for practical purposes. That's insane. And we have to just get angry and stubborn when these people try this bullshit on us. Gender. I'm sorry, words have genders. People have sexes, okay? Gender is a grammatical concept. It does not belong in serious discussions of sex and sexual behavior, because gender is the idea of the socially constructed role. It's an attempt to basically deny biology, and we just have to call bullshit on this and be stubborn enough to stand up for what we see with our own eyes. And there's a lot of fake science that is basically an attempt to swindle us, if you will, into thinking we have to trust these authorities. We can't trust our own experience. Now, in terms of things like this, whether the Earth is a sphere or a flat surface, there are actually experiences that you can adduce that support the sphere thing. But let's set that aside. We do need to be more trustful of our own experience. And if somebody is going to argue that the things that we experience are radically untrue, they better have extraordinary evidence for it. Okay. So I think that's important. Folks, if you would like to help us out with your DLive tokens, your diamonds, lemons, ninjaginis, ice cream, ninjets, dare I hope for a ninjet or two, we'd very much appreciate it. So you can send those our way as well, and they will help us keep the signal strong. So, Frody, what are your thoughts on this question of the week? Should we trust the science?
Yeah, I want to make 3 points, really, about that. And the first point, well, I'm usually the champion of the working man and pretty much opposed to intellectuals generally. I'm a reluctant intellectual. But you have to be sort of uneducated to believe in the concept of trust the science. Because if you've spent any time at a university, you'll have noticed immediately that scientists disagree on pretty much everything. So trust the science is a ridiculous concept just from that point of view. And of course, in this case with COVID, they disagreed with themselves from week to week and month to month. So the trust the science trope is ridiculous just from that point of view. The second thing I want to mention is just as an example, how they've treated people who dissent. And one example is, of course, Michael Yeadon, who is this British guy. Most of you will have heard of him. And he used to work for Pfizer in development of medicine. And he has objected to the rollout of the new mRNA vaccine. And he has argued against this passionately. And this is something that I brought up in the live streams that I did with JF about fact-checking the pandemic. That I'm looking at an article from Reuters, which is a reputable news source, news agency. And when they are doing their story about Michael Yeadon, they are talking about how worried they are about him. They interview old colleagues about how worried they are about Michael Yeadon. They don't present any arguments refuting Michael Yeadon's claims. They smear him. And they also interview a guy called Imran Ahmed, who is the chief executive of the Center for Countering Digital Hate. So scientists from the medicine industry disagreeing with the narrative, that is now an object of hate or a topic of hate. So it's not a scientific disagreement. No, it's hate. You need a watchdog group like ADL or something like that to comment on what these people say. So you don't present a scientist refuting the actual claims. You smear the man with an ad hominem, and you do it through a watchdog group. That's a highly suspicious method of dealing with scientific issues. So that sort of also undermines this whole narrative of trusting the science. And the third thing I want to bring up is, and this is something that I've said all the time, that I wish the trust the science people would actually trust the science, because the science that their sort of official sources have presented, things like the CDC and the WHO, well, their statistics aren't really all that scary. And the information that we get from the mainstream media and from the governments is sort of misleading. It's misleading to an extent where it's essentially disinformation at this point, I would say. I can just give you some examples. And one example is the numbers of deaths where people who have been, I mean, if you want to get the number of or the fatality of a virus, the infection fatality rate of a virus, you want to include people who were actually killed by the virus. But what's happened here with the statistics is that anyone who's tested positive for COVID and dies afterwards, be it in a car accident or falls off a roof or gets shot, they're included in the statistics. this is not a normal way to do this. So I mean, that in itself just is misleading. And another thing is that they just give you a bunch of numbers without saying what those numbers mean. So they say that so and so many people are sick and you have a lot of cases. It's always about the cases, of course. But what they fail to communicate or what they under-communicate is that there are very clear risk categories that some people need to be scared of the virus, some people not. And people who are young people and kids, well, for them, COVID is less dangerous than the flu. For older people, it is more dangerous than the flu. And this is under-communicated. You can't make people terrified of a virus through that kind of misleading information and misleading presentation of the sources. And this is all based on the official sources in the CDC and the WHO. And the third thing is about the vaccine, where they have rolled out this hastily rolled out novel medicine technology, the mRNA vaccine, and they want everyone to get it. Well, there are several problems with it. For one, in the normal situation, you try to not give vaccines to people who already have immunity, because that can actually increase the risk of adverse effects. Second of all, this is a medicine or a medical product with an emergency authorization. But for children and young people, COVID is no emergency at all. So none of this makes sense. And also they want to circumvent the fundamental principle of informed consent, which is one of the cornerstones of how we do medicine in the West. Informed consent, that you should be given full information and the ability to say yes or no to a medical treatment. But this is all crazy the way this has been treated. And yeah, they don't do it in alignment with their own science. So the people controlling the narrative do not trust the science, if there is such a thing, because not even the numbers that they rely on, those numbers don't suggest the actual actions that Western governments have taken.
Yeah, that's well said. I want to tell a story. This is a absolute favorite story of mine. I first learned about this from Louis Ferdinand Céline, whose first work, Céline was a physician. And the first book that he wrote was a book about a Hungarian doctor named Ignaz Semmelweis. And Ignaz Semmelweis is probably, in terms of the number of lives saved and the importance of a particular medical discovery, probably the greatest benefactor of mankind ever to have MD behind his name, ever to wear the white coat. So Semmelweis was born in Hungary in 1818. And he was working in the Vienna General Hospital, and he noticed that there were two obstetric wards in the hospital. One was a ward where doctors delivered babies, and the other was a ward where midwives delivered babies. And he noticed that this phenomenon called puerperal fever or childbed fever, which killed many, many women in the 19th century, was much higher in the wards where doctors delivered babies rather than than midwives delivered babies. And so he did a study of this, and he hypothesized that the reason why women who had doctors deliver their babies were dying at high rates from childbed fever was that doctors routinely went around in the hospitals poking their fingers into septic wounds and dealing with sick people and cutting open cadavers and things like that. And then they would go with their hands covered with filth and disease and deliver babies. Whereas midwives didn't do any of this other gross stuff, they would just deliver babies. And so his hypothesis was that the dirty hands of doctors were killing mothers. And he wrote a book called The Etiology Concept and Prophylaxis of Childbed Fever. And he basically started washing hands with chlorinated lime solutions, and recommending that doctors do this. And it reduced mortality to below 1% where this was done. Now, you would think that this man would be hailed a hero by the medical profession. Instead, the medical profession basically drove him into madness. They mocked him for it. He had a nervous breakdown, and his colleagues committed him to a mental institution where he was beaten by guards and died 14 days later from a gangrenous wound that he received in this beating. This is how the man who discovered that doctors were killing women with their filthy, unwashed hands was treated by the medical profession. Now, you can say that we need to trust the science, and that's true in a sense. I trust science in the very long run. You know, in the long run, if it works and eliminates false theories and comes up with true theories and tests them and establishes them. But this is the kind of behavior that you can routinely expect of quote-unquote scientists and doctors. In the short run, they will mock you. They will have whispering campaigns. They will try and destroy your career. They will get you thrown into a lunatic asylum where you will be killed. This is what happened to Semmelweis in 1865 when he died. He was basically driven insane, thrown in an asylum, and murdered. But eventually, the doctors did accept his findings. He wasn't around to see it. His five children didn't have a father. But eventually, over the long run, the science won out. The truth won out. The trouble is that you and I and everybody who is in the crosshairs of the scientific establishment run by these absolute megalomaniacs like Anthony Fauci and Bill Gates, we are in the position of the Ignaz Semmelweises of the world. We're the short-term victims, you know, in the long-term march of science towards truth. And we have to bristle at that. There's another story that I love to tell. This is the story of a disease called pellagra, P-E-L-L-A-G-R-A. Pellagra is basically a vitamin deficiency that causes a terrible skin disease and other symptoms that kill people. And pellagra became a thing. It first became noticed in, I think it was in the 18th century. It became noticed after corn from the New World was brought to the Old World and became a staple crop. And if you get pellagra, you will die in a few years without treatment. And a lot of people thought, okay, this is caused by either a toxin in corn, because they did notice that there was some connection with corn, or a microbe of a virus or a bacterium in corn. And this was believed for decades and decades. There were people who were quarantined, you know, there were panics, there were outbreaks of pellagra. And it took decades before a doctor named Dr. Joseph Goldberger, who was a Hungarian-born Jew in the United States, noticed that pellagra didn't behave like an infectious disease at all. It only affected certain classes of people. It only affected people of certain ages. When there were pellagra patients in hospitals, doctors and nurses did not come down with pellagra. It did not follow any of the patterns of an infectious disease. Finally, after decades, he convinced the medical establishment that pellagra was a vitamin deficiency. It was caused by a B vitamin deficiency. It took decades to convince people of that. And pellagra is basically eliminated in the developed world because of vitamin B3 or niacin supplements. And the reason why it happened was that there were a lot of very poor people in rural areas who were eating diets very heavy in corn and lacking in niacin. And again, there were no signs that this was actually an infectious disease by the canons of epidemiology. It didn't fit any of the canons of epidemiology, but it took decades for this doctor to convince the medical profession of this fact. And once they were convinced, it's basically been eliminated. So in the long run, trust the science. In the short run, you better run for your lives because the science can be inimical to your health and well-being if they're stubborn, arrogant pricks who are basically wedded to false theories. Doctors are arrogant folks for the most part, and the very idea that they and their filthy habits could be the cause of women dying of childbed fever was just unthinkable to them. Well, they were wrong about that. So it's very, very important to recognize that, yeah, in the long run, science might come through, but in the short run, it's very, very hard. And that short run can take decades. And we have to be very, very careful about that. So anyway, Woz, do you have any other thoughts on this?
No, I think... it's as I said, I think it's interesting that it's happening now. We were taught, we were raised to think that to think of science as something that is has replaced religion. It's in, you know, logic, rationality, reason, and all that. And I think it hasn't replaced religion. I think it's something that it's a new religion now. And that's what interests me. You know, how is science now figuring in people's psychology and in the culture? Because I think it's different than it was even 5 years ago, as a result of COVID, and that's being directed by the media and the governments and NGOs and so on. So that's the aspect of it that I think is most interesting.
Yeah, Frody, do you have any further thoughts on this?
Well, what they could call it instead of trust the science is trust the chutzpah, because really, if you just look at the empirical evidence, the empirical evidence doesn't at all suggest the actions that have been taken by Western governments. And also the chutzpah in us being in a normal situation during the summer and not wearing masks and being allowed into bars and living a relatively normal life, and then come fall, autumn, we're going to pretend that now it's all dangerous again when everything has been fine in the summer. I mean, yeah, I know that numbers of cases fluctuates with the seasons because of the weather, but still, I mean, that's absolutely ridiculous, and that the controls or the restrictions are getting tighter as time goes by and the disease becomes less dangerous. The more people who have already been infected, the more people that are already immune to this virus. And I haven't seen anything convincing suggesting that reinfection really does happen at a significant rate. So, I mean, the more people that are already immune and when there's less to fear from this virus as time goes by, the restrictions become tighter. This is really, really crazy that we're expected to just buy this narrative. So yeah, they should just call it trust the chutzpah instead of trust the science, because what they're doing goes contrary to what their own numbers would suggest, even from the CDC and the WHO.
That's interesting. Another factor here is that the lab leak hypothesis looks increasingly likely to be true. So we're being asked to trust the people who cooked this up, right? I mean, if we're going to be talking in very general global terms about the science, well, the science cooked this up in its laboratory and let it out on the world. And we turn to these people for our salvation. The arrogance and the megalomania of these shitheads is astonishing. And it turns out that it's the same shitheads are involved here. It's Fauci. Fauci's hiding money that he was sending through the WHO for the research that gave us COVID in all likelihood. Also, just the sheer amount of Chinese propaganda, the Chinese lying, let's just call it what it is. The Chinese have been lying about this, and they've been very, very effective. They bought the New York Times. The New York Times is just an they bought Chinese propaganda in the New York Times, and not just about COVID, but about foreign policy related issues too. The New York Times just sold itself and made itself into a Chinese propaganda rag. So there is a lot more than just the facts that are dictating narratives here. It's politics, it's commerce, it's moral signaling, it's hysteria. America is basically ruled by what appears to be a religious cult. If you just sort of step back and try and look at it naively, imagine yourself a newly arrived Afghan refugee in the United States. States studying American government, you might think that the United States is run by something akin to the Taliban. In what sense? Well, basically, we're run by not a tribe that's biologically related so much as a bunch of people who share the same belief system and who are hysterical and punitive and hateful. And they hate the masses. They hate red America. They hate white America. They hate ordinary people. And they're not even consistent about their phony beliefs oftentimes. Sometimes they choose their phony beliefs just because they want to basically one up the people they hate or steal a, you know, they want to put down the people they hate. COVID, the jabs, the science, the masks, all of these are tribal markers of belonging by the hostile elite that runs this country. And it's nothing more than that for most of these people. They're simply a hateful bunch of people who are running the country into the ground. And they want to use these signaling mechanisms like wearing their masks in their car and so forth. Signaling about their jabs, getting goddamn tattoos of like Pfizer tattooed on their bodies. This is not rational behavior. This is the behavior of people who are in the grip of basically a kind of religious mentality, a cult-like religious mentality. And science is simply one means by which they signal their belonging to the hostile elite and by which they put down the people that they hate. These are factors here, and these are not factors that have anything to do with the objective reality. None whatsoever.
Yeah, I just want to mention one article that's one of the best comments that I've seen in the mainstream media about this, and that's an article in The Atlantic from a couple of months ago, maybe April, perhaps May, saying exactly that COVID has simply become a political marker. It's become an in-group political in-group identity marker where people signal their political identity through their attitudes to COVID. And although the threat level of COVID or the dangers of COVID goes down, some people on the left actually want even tighter restrictions because that's their political identity and that's their way of signaling and out-signaling each other.
Well, if I could intervene, I think that it seems to me that the point all along was to get to where we are now, where, I mean, the COVID pass, vaccination, I think that this was always on the cards. I think this was always what they were driving towards. I think this is why the virus was really hyped up as a terrible thing, why the vaccine has been basically mandated, 80% mandated at this point. And the other things, like the threat of the variants and how of reinfection and asymptomatic spread and so on. This, I think, was the point all along was to remodel the world and the way that we live. And if you look at what's happening in France right now, it's absolutely incredible the restrictions that are going on now. If you hold on a second, I can. There's a summary that I read earlier today. Sporting events, theatres, cinemas, museums, bars, coffee shops, restaurants, all of that is now out of bounds to the unvaccinated. All doctors, nurses and health industry workers are mandated to be vaccinated. And I think from December onwards, it's going to be even small shops, grocery stores and so on. So basically, it will be impossible. The only way to get food, if you're not vaccinated, will be to order it over the internet. But otherwise, you simply cannot function in normal world. unless you're vaccinated. And then, of course, if you are vaccinated, you're still subject to random spot checks. There was footage of the police scanning people. I think that was in France, or it might have been Germany, about a week ago. Just casually, that the police walking around, demanding that people show them their COVID pass on their mobile phone to confirm that they've been vaccinated. This is a completely different, let's say it's a radically different way of living from what we had 18 months ago and centuries before that. This is a sea change in the way we live and the relationship that we have with authority. This is like something out of a totalitarian state. It's not something that we are accustomed to, but it's something that's been slipped in. Not even slipped in. It's been very overtly done, and the public have been reshaped so as to clamour for this to be done. And it's all been done under the auspices of trusting the science, to bring it back to the original thing. So, but that's the point. That's why the science has been elevated to this godlike status, because it then justifies this radical reshaping of daily life.
So let's look at a few questions here that have come in on entropy. Folks, if you'd like to help out and be heard, go to entropystream.live/countercurrents and leave your donation and your question or comment, and we will get to it in the course of today's stream. So Jasper writes in with $50. That's very generous. Thank you. I hear many people, especially boomers, describe current American politics as a pendulum swinging back and forth between left and right. I see U.S. politics more like a ratchet that forever lurches left, and that this movement is a demographic inflection point that will only pull us further to the left. How would you respond to the pendulum analogy? Exactly as you have responded to it. It doesn't go back and forth, left and right. That's superficial. That's true. I mean, you get Republicans and Democrats, but the Republicans of this year are basically the Democrats of 10 years ago. So there's a superficial pendulum back and forth between left and right, but the entire spectrum is moving steadily towards the left. And I think that that is just simply the truth. And why does that happen? Well, I've written about that a bit at Countercurrents. I have this essay on metapolitics and occult warfare, for instance. And in there, I quote Robert Louis Dabney, who is a Southern Presbyterian minister, actually, and a truly brilliant political commentator, writing, I think, in 1870. And he was predicting that women's suffrage, which 10 years before was like a tiny cult, and then in 1870 was a growing thing, would sweep the nation eventually. Why? Because of the nature of its opponents, the Northern conservatives. He said Northern conservatives put up a show of resisting the latest craziness that comes from the left. And then after putting up a show for a while, they quietly surrender to it and then start carping about the next innovation of the left. But they never stop it. They just complain and bitch and delay and shuffle their feet. But they never actually do anything about it. And so the trend is always ratcheting to the left. The left has the courage of conviction and fanaticism. And they also have a fifth column in the minds of the people on the right, which is that the people on the right basically believe the same egalitarian nonsense that the leftists believe. They're just a little slower about it. They're a little more morally complacent because they've got theirs, et cetera. But they believe the same BS in the end, which is why they always lose. And to have a right that wins, you've got to reject the underlying egalitarian premises of the right, of the left. We don't have a right like that in America. The only right that we had like that in America was historically, say, the Southern agrarian types. They were anti-liberal, anti-egalitarian, and now we have the North American New Right, which is the term that I give to what we're doing at Countercurrents. We are rejecting explicitly egalitarianism. We're rejecting the absurd idea that racism and identity politics is the worst thing in the world, but only if it benefits white people. It's fine for all the others to do it. That is the stupid dogma that the David Frenches of the world and the other cuckservatives believe. And this is why they are a fake opposition. They put up a show and then they surrender. And then they complain about the next innovation of the left, but they never stop it. They never even slow it down. And they certainly never reverse it. Woz, do you have any thoughts on this?
I'm not sure. Could you summarize the question?
Well, the question is, he says that people have this pendulum analogy. Power goes like a pendulum, swinging between left and right and left and right. And he says, no, it's not really the case, because he thinks that everything ratchets to the left. And the ratchet only turns one way. It doesn't turn back. And
yes,
is superficial.
Yes, I think that makes far more sense to me, just from looking at the way that people are. The left, as you said, the left have a sort of moral conviction, a feverish moral conviction, a self-righteousness that the right, the conservative, cannot compete with. And so this is why the conservative ends up, even when he gets into power, and we have the pendulum has swung to the right, and we've got 5 years or 10 years of conservative government, the conservative ends up just doing what the leftist was campaigning for anyway. And we've seen this again and again. I mean, you know, everyone thinks that Margaret Thatcher's government in the 80s was really right wing, but immigration increased throughout that. Her tenure as prime minister, and spending on the welfare state increased throughout her tenure. So really it's difficult to, and of course everything, you know, the culture, Jim, you know, multiculturalism came in explicitly under her government in 1981. And the same could be said of the David Cameron's conservative government. They were the ones who brought in gay marriage in, I think it was 2012. Trump, well, supposedly this far-right fascist president, and yet virtually the whole BLM thing happened during his tenure. Not all of it. There was Trayvon Martin before all of that, but certainly the bulk of it happened under his tenure. Charlottesville, the statues. That's all under Trump. So, and he ended up acquiescing to all of that. And we can go into why he acquiesced. It doesn't really matter. The culture was flowing clearly in one direction, as directed by the mainstream media. I mean, this all comes down to the mainstream media. It's possible that in an age that didn't have the mainstream media, it was more of a pendulum, and it's basically just a constantly self-correcting mechanism where we have a bit of that, then we have a bit of the other. Possibly, I don't know. But definitely in our lifetimes, I think the mainstream media has dictated that culture moves ever leftward.
Yeah, Frody, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I have a saying by now, because I've said it so often, that if Karl Marx were alive today saying the same things he said back then, he would be considered a Nazi. That's how far the entire political spectrum has drifted to the left in the last 100, 150 years. So power does not swing from left to right. The entire paradigm drifts to the left, or is pulled to the left, or pushed to the left. And a more recent example is probably the idea that gay couples should be allowed to adopt children, which in the 90s, most people didn't find that acceptable. Now it's not acceptable to object to it. And also the idea of feminism. I remember in Sweden, I think it was the leftist party, the communists. They were the first to call themselves feminists. And then all other parties followed suit in a matter of just a few years, and now all parties call themselves feminists. And all these little changes, step by step, they happen. They are steps to the left. So it doesn't really matter on a sort of a cosmetic level if the power supposedly drifts to the right or to the left. It always goes to the left. And just as Woz said, the same thing goes for Sweden with mass immigration. When the rightist with rightist governments or right of center governments versus left of center governments, immigration usually increases with right of center governments, although the mass media narrative keeps up this good cop bad cop story, the narrative suggesting that right-wing governments are against immigration. They're inhumane in their treatment of immigration, but immigration always goes up. There, we get more immigration with right-wing governments. So it's fake, and it's on a very, very superficial level, if even that. We have this pendulum swing from left to right because it always goes leftwards.
Yeah, well said. I have to apologize to the folks on DLive who have been sending us lemons. I can't see a bunch of the donations that have come in. And I think that's because I waited and every hour they basically reset this. And so we just got carried away talking. So folks, I know Alaska Chaga sent some. I know Nick Gilby sent some. And I know others were very generous. And I didn't read it out. I apologize. I didn't read it in time and now I can't see it. Malthus, okay. Gadius has just donated a diamond. Top of the hour, dump them lemons, he says. Thank you very much. Nick Gilvey, one ice cream and four lemons. And folks, if you would toss in those tokens, it does help a whole lot. So let's go back to entropy. We have a very thoughtful comment here with $25 from Horatio Nelson. I have been a university scientist for 3 decades. One thing that is rarely mentioned is that scientists are extremely loyal to their class and will take its side even when they know that it is wrong on policy or data, and they punish nonconformists with expulsion. James Watson was unpersoned for mild remarks about IQ. Absolutely right. Another thing that I think makes people somewhat vaccine resistant is the opioid epidemic. What is the opioid epidemic? It's tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people who have died and many, many more who have become hopelessly addicted and harmed by pharmaceuticals that are being pushed by a big pharmaceutical company for money, basically. And so when you hear people talking about the new miracle drug and everybody's got to have it, people start worrying. I start worrying. And there's good reason. And the lesson for this to the elites that are listening is don't debauch public trust by telling us lies like diversity is a strength, like globalization will make us all richer, like race is a social construct, like trans women are women. Don't tell us these outrageous lies, because if a real crisis comes along, and let's just say that COVID is a real crisis for sake of argument, if a real crisis comes along, people won't believe you, and then you're stuck. This is what's happening. COVID, I think, has been overrated. I think it's been overblown. I think it was reasonable early on to take it seriously because it could have been a really bad thing, but it's been around long enough and we know the risks. And it's foolish to be hysterical about this disease anymore. And it's foolish to demand that people who are not at risk for it should get vaccinations. That could be, the vaccine is more of a threat to most people than the disease is at this point. And it's simply madness to demand, for instance, that children get these vaccines. There are some diseases that are serious enough that you want the whole population vaccinated. like smallpox or something like that. If there were a vaccine for the Spanish influenza or something like that, and it came back in a new form, you would definitely want to do that. In the past, there have been smallpox outbreaks, and I think in New York City, I forget which year, they basically required everybody to get a smallpox vaccination. Smallpox doesn't exist anymore because of vaccination. However, COVID is more like, and I only use this analogy in a limited sense, it's more like the seasonal flu in this sense, that it only really threatens old people and people with compromised immune systems, and they're the ones who should be getting vaccines. And they're the ones who should be socially isolating and things like that. The rest of life needs to go on as before. That's the sensible thing to do. We need to treat this like the seasonal flu when it comes to vaccination and things like social distancing and so forth. Gaudius, go ahead.
There's also another thing that I want to add, Greg, that this new mRNA vaccine isn't a vaccine. I mean, it performs the same service. It serves the same function as a vaccine, but it isn't a vaccine because it's a completely new technology. And it is crazy to have a shorter test period for a new technology than you have for the regular old-fashioned vaccines that we know well, and to use a completely new technology and then just follow up for a couple of months and then release it to a billion people who most of them don't even need it, that's crazy. And someone commented in a video I saw a couple of days ago that this thing, the vaccination started in, I think it was December 2020. So we're sort of coming up on the 9-month timeline here, right? So that if someone got pregnant or was pregnant, we'll see the effects on the children born from vaccinated mothers. And it's crazy to not wait for that information before you vaccinate or inject a billion or 2 billion people with this novel technology. I just hope that there won't be any huge side effects because we don't know about them, because they didn't take the time to study long-term effects before giving it to the masses.
Most thalidomide of them don't even know marketed it as a miracle drug. Remember thalidomide? Yeah, exactly. And lobotomy gets them home. That was the slogan: lobotomize people and you can send them home. It's absolutely appalling, the butchery and suffering caused by short-term science. You know, again, I will grant that in the long run, we can trust science. In the short run, we should not be the guinea pigs. You should not be a guinea pig in the short run. So Gaudius writes in with $25. Did any of you gentlemen expect there to be fewer whites in America today than 10 years ago? Isn't this undeniable proof of the great replacement that you should be able to bring up in casual conversation with normies? Well, yeah, I kind of expected it. I didn't think it would be necessarily the case in this census. I think part of this is, interestingly enough, because a lot of Hispanics are reclassifying themselves as not white, which only meant that a lot of non-white people or marginally white people, off-white people, in the past were swelling the white numbers. And of course, Arabs are considered white in our census categories too. Real white people in America might be barely clinging to 50% already. And yes, this is good because it red pills the normies. It's proof that the great great replacement's taking place. Jews and leftists are maliciously cackling about this and rubbing their hands together on social media. I'm keeping screenshots. I think we should all keep screenshots of this kind of stuff because it's very, very useful to us. There is one thing I'd like to say. When my ancestors first arrived in the North American continent, it was at Jamestown. And white people were a tiny minority on the North American continent in Jamestown, and they still took the whole continent. And it can happen again. Really, you just need the will. You need a bit of a demographic wind behind your back. We had the demographic wind of the old world, overpopulation. People were leaving the old world looking for opportunities to take care of their families, right? All the sob stories that we're supposed to listen to and throw open our border to the third world. That was why people came to North America from Europe and settled here. But it was mostly will that made white people end up conquering and civilizing. We didn't conquer every bit of it. Some of it we bought, some of it was unoccupied. We can't, concede anything to these exaggerated, stupid anti-colonialist, anti-white narratives. But we settled this continent and we made a great home here. And we started out as a tiny minority. And so we can do it again. Frody, what are your thoughts on this? The new census data is out. And for the first time since 1790, the number of white people in America has shrunk from one census to another.
Yeah, I usually mention this, the news that came out in 2012. I remember it well. When that was the year that the number of children born in America were majority non-white. So that of all the kids born in 2012, a minority, less than 50%, were white. So that's when we already passed the tipping point. And usually these demographic change reports and the year given that at this year, that's when we'll be minority Swedes in Sweden or minority English in England or whatever. Those are overly optimistic because the relevant change happens years before that. Because the relevant part of the population when it comes to power, when it comes to influencing how society works, that isn't the older people, the people over 70 years old. I mean, I'm not going to say that those people don't count. But when we talk about the attitudes and how society works, the really relevant parts of that population is the people of fertile age, the people who can have kids. And the fact is that the immigrants are young. The people coming to our countries are young. And our native population is old. We haven't had kids lately. So we have more old people than young people. So the power shift happens long before the actual year when we cross the magical 50% line. And I think that's very important to keep in mind, because already now you see cities in Sweden, for example, where, look at the schools. I think the schools are a very good measurement of how a country looks. And if you look at the schools and you see maybe a third white students in a school, that's alarming. And then the sort of 80-year-olds and 70-year-olds, that's not as relevant for how the country actually works.
Yeah. We've been predicting this for a very long time. We've been warning people for a very long time. But of course, people don't listen to warnings. They believe their own eyes. And if you want to see what all of America is going to be like in the future, you can get in a time machine, you can get in an airplane, and you can fly to California and see what it's going to be like in the future. Or you can fly to New York City and see what it's going to be like in the future. A majority non-white America is not a place that most white people are comfortable living. It's simply not. Or go to the local elementary school and look at the kids at recess. That's the future. It's coming at us. And people who say, oh, there's nothing we can do about it now. Nonsense. Those are just whiny black pillars. There's nothing they can do about it now within the current paradigm of liberal democracy, which has gotten us into this mess in the first place. We have to think outside the liberal democratic paradigm. If during Reconstruction in the South, a non-white regime of basically, well, blacks were empowered during Reconstruction, and they tyrannized over the South and mucked up everything where they had any kind of political power. How did that come to an end? People basically restricted the franchise and got them to stop voting, took away their votes, raised the quality of life tremendously. The point is that we don't necessarily have to abide by democracy. And as our countries look more like banana republics, so they should function more like banana republics. And that means just say, okay, I'm sorry, these people who are here voting to ratchet things further to the left, we're taking away their votes. We're just going to nullify their votes. That's the first step before we repatriate them. We're going to have to think outside the democratic box. The democratic box is a coffin. It's the coffin of white America. And we're simply not going to allow us to be taken to the graveyard of history in the box of democracy. We've got to get outside that box, and we will. So just because they might be a numerical majority doesn't mean that it's finished. It just means that democracy is finished. And good riddance. We can come up with something better. So anyway, Woz, do you have any thoughts on this?
Not really. Nothing that you've not already said. It's okay. It's one of those issues where we've been warning about it for years. For a long time. You two have been talking about it for longer than I have. I started in 2014. And it's, you pay a heavy price for talking about it. And yet it still continues. And that's the depressing thing about it. I think it's going to continue until our societies fall apart and it simply can't continue anymore. That's what I've thought for years. And it seems to be that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Folks, if you would like to get in the conversation and also help us keep the signal strong, please go to entropystream.live/countercurrents and leave a question, comment, and donation, and we will definitely get to it in the course of the stream. So I want to zip back now to Entropy. Steve writes in with $50. Keep up the good work. Thank you, Steve. We really appreciate your support. Unknown Californian has written in with three donations of $3 each. The same people who think men can become pregnant are the same ones who are pushing for the jab. Yeah, in fact, I'm sure there's some pregnant men who are actually getting them the jab too. What's another strange cocktail in their bloodstream, right? What's up with this other countercurrents website I accidentally found? Well, that is a left-wing website from India. And every once in a while, I get some writer writing in some Pajit or Patel or Rabinder something or other, sending vaguely Marxoid articles to countercurrents. And I always write back and say, I think you got the wrong countercurrents. But anyway, one time an article like this came in. It was from some Westerner, so the name didn't look a little odd. And because it was like, well, it's a little too narrowly economic, but it sort of fits in with our populist outlook. And then the writer sheepishly wrote in, my God, so anyway, Unknown California also writes in, school is back in session. I forgot and went down the street to the high school, the street the high school is on. Every single kid wore their mask walking home to their parents' waiting vehicle. My mind was boggled. Well, it's California and, they're afraid, basically. Everyone's afraid in California. So I have a bunch of short little questions here that have come in. So folks, let's do some fast questions, and then we can get back into some heavier questions, okay? We're going to lighten up the stream a bit. So Eric writes in, when and where were you happiest? Well, I have to say I was happiest when I was living in San Francisco from 2010 to 2014 and just starting out countercurrents. I really liked it there. Since then, San Francisco has turned into a complete shithole, and I don't even like going back It's a beautiful city. I think it's America's most beautiful city. And I like the weather. I like cool weather. You always know the tourists in San Francisco because they're wearing shorts and t-shirts and freezing their asses off because they think they're coming to sunny California and they don't know that Northern California has a whole different climate. Anyway, Woz, when and where were you the happiest?
Oh, God. That's a really difficult question to answer because I have enjoyed various various eras of my life. I remember my childhood very fondly. Then there are eras at school and at art college and beyond that. And then with my channel, I don't know. I can't really answer that question. I think if you were to ask me if I could go anywhere in my life and just watch a day in my life at that point, it would be my childhood. It would be when I was 6, 7 years old, because I think everything at the time, everything seemed just fine and safe and comfortable. That's the bit that I would be most interested to relive, as it were, to watch it playing out. I think that's the only answer I can really give. It's difficult question. I'm sorry.
So, Frody, when and where were you happiest?
Well, yeah, probably also my childhood. And where? I think I'm happy pretty much anywhere in Scandinavia, at least. I'm wedded to Scandinavia, but I've lived here and there in Scandinavia and Norway, Sweden, Faroes, and I just enjoy being in nature. So when I enjoy life the most, it's always out in nature. I tend to find the big city anthills kind of depressing. I mean, they're fun for a little while, but then they become kind of depressing. I do enjoy being in more sort of rural places. But yeah, I have fond memories from my childhood as well.
That's great. You know, I have some fond memories from my childhood, but I can't say that I was happiest as a child. I really feel I was happiest as an adult. Andrew King writes in with one Ninja Genie. What was the name of that Southern fellow in the 1880s or in the 1800s who predicted W-I-S Dabney, D-A-B-N-E-Y? I'm actually going to republish a piece by him at Countercurrents in the coming week called Women's Rights Women. It's kind of a clumsy title, but it's about the feminist movement. It's one of the most perceptive arguments about the farce of conservatism, the weakness of conservatism that I've ever seen. It's really worth quoting. So yeah, let's look at a couple other shortish questions. Eric also asks, favorite Martin Scorsese movies? Well, my favorite Martin Scorsese movies are Gangs of New York and The Aviator. And I've written reviews of both of those. You can find them at Countercurrents under the Trevor Lynch pen name. Woz, do you like any Scorsese films?
I actually have hardly seen any. I've only seen Taxi Driver. God, I think that is the only one. So no, it never appealed like his. I know he's done other things, Kundun. He did, and I was curious about that, but I never got around to seeing it. And The Aviator. But most of his films tend to be violent, gangster stuff, and it's just not my. It just never appealed to me. So I never really watched Scorsese. But I'm sure I would get something out of it if I did. You know, he is obviously an extremely talented director.
Great, Frody. Do you have any Scorsese films that you like?
Yeah, I do like. I also like. Let me see here. I actually like Shutter Island, and I like the book. It's one of the very few sort of modern popular books that I've read. But I enjoyed that film. Gangs of New York, definitely. I do like, what's his name? Daniel Day-Lewis's character. He's a brilliant, charismatic character in that film. Of course, Goodfellas is a classic. What else? Yeah, Taxi Driver. Taxi Driver is great. I don't enjoy watching it. I've seen it many times, but yeah, I do like Taxi Driver. I can't say which one is, you know, the one favorite. That would probably be Taxi Driver, though.
Okay. So Lovecraft's Cat has written in. Oh, by the way, I want to give a shout out to the U.S. population dropping for the first time since 1790. Go ahead. Lovecraft's Cat asked us to comment on Deborah Lipstadt becoming some kind of special plenipotentiary global envoy to combat anti-Semitism. Well, I just think that is very appropriate for the Biden administration because the whole damn country is becoming a joke. And Deborah Lipstadt is a joke of a scholar. She is an absolutely just wretched, boring writer who's written two extremely bad books that seemed barely publishable to me. And she has been hoisted up by her tribal affiliations and turned into a hero. There was a movie made about her challenging David Irving, her brave fight against David Irving, because David Irving is a very threatening figure. And of course, she was played by. And now she is going to go around the world somehow combating anti-Semitism on behalf of the U.S. government, because what other purpose does the U.S. government have? But, you know, certainly not looking out for the interests of the American people, but fighting anti-Semitism, that's a job that the U.S. government can definitely get behind. There's a hilarious meme that I saw on social media today. It's from, what was it? It's from Jurassic Park. It's the old founder of Jurassic Park, the white-haired fellow. The park is going crazy. It's being overrun by the animals, and he's getting on a helicopter to fly out. And the caption is, something to the effect that the U.S. ambassador to Kabul takes one longing look at the unfinished Holocaust memorial before being evacuated, or something to that effect. And I just thought that was beautiful. But yeah, I just think it's basically shows that America is a joke of a country that is run by aliens who basically have subverted it to look out for their own ethnic interests. It's certainly not something that a serious country would do. Frody, do you have any thoughts on, have you followed the Lipstadt nomination to be this global ambassador against anti-Semitism?
You want to go first, Woz?
Well, I don't know anything about it, so no.
Okay. Frody?
Well, I tend to think that it's always a good thing when these things that are already true implicitly, when they become explicit, so we can talk about them and point to them. That's why I thought that it was a good thing when Obama became president, for example, because we're going to have an anti-white American president either way, so we might as well see that he's anti-white so we can point to it and talk about it. And it's really the same thing here, that anti-Semitism envoy, it's absolutely ridiculous, but that's essentially what we have anyway, you know, just people looking out for Jewish interests. So we might as well have it official, make it official, so we can talk about it and criticize it. So yeah, from that point of view, I think it's a good thing. But don't expect an anti-whiteness envoy anytime soon. Although Tucker has been bringing it up quite explicitly lately, but yeah, I would nominate Jared Taylor too as the American anti-whiteness envoy.
Yeah, I think that would be good. He can comport himself in an ambassadorial style. Lovecraft's Cat also writes in, what about women's rights in Afghanistan? Well, I do think that it's very rich that now that, of course, everyone's been watching the Afghan regime collapsing in record time and the Taliban taking over after America spent, what, trillions of dollars? How many people have died there trying to terraform Afghanistan into a liberal democracy where every woman dresses like a whore? And Cyndi Lauper blasts from loudspeakers everywhere. Suddenly, you know, the Black Lives Matter. I'm terrified that the George Floyd mural will be the Bamiyan were destroyed by these Taliban fanatics. The American regime there, American occupation regime, the puppet regime folded up overnight, practically. And again, America is a joke country. It's very appropriate that this happened during the joke Biden administration. And I love how suddenly people are concerned about the rights of women in Afghanistan and speaking out of this, the other side of their mouths are talking about bringing Afghan refugees to our countries. These people are never concerned about what refugees from that part of the world do to white women and girls. But we are supposed to stay entangled in that mess, entangled with that tar baby because of women's rights over there. I'm sorry, that's just silliness. And it gets more and more transparent every time. Just how self-contradictory and empty these people are. Woz, you did stuff about Rotherham and all the grooming gangs and everything like that. Do you think that the British Parliament should be called back into session to deal with the emergency of how to protect the girls of Afghanistan from the Taliban?
Well, obviously, no, I don't. Morgoth actually put up a really good post about this, sort of conundrum that, hold on a second. Okay, liberals are concerned about what will happen to women and girls because of Muslim men in Afghanistan. But when those Muslim men come rocking up in Europe, the same liberals see only half-starved refugees deserving care and love. If anyone points out that these refugees might also be a danger to our girls, they get called a racist. And I know that they can live with this level of hypocrisy quite comfortably. But that's an interesting thing that he pointed out there. There's a complete 180 in the liberal attitude to these men is once they get to Europe. You know, once they get to Europe, suddenly these men are cuddly and vulnerable, which is amazing. But if they stay in Afghanistan, then they're crazed, misogynist killers, theocratic warlords and so on, who are a danger to everyone around them. But if they get here, if they get to Europe, then they're just great. I mean, that is insane, absolutely insane cognitive dissonance there. I don't know what to say about it. I just, you start to fall back on cliches that there's something severely wrong about the liberal psyche.
There's something in the water. Yeah, Brody, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I can only agree. It just shows that ideology trumps reality or perception. I posted a thing on my Telegram channel just today about an Arab in Sweden having he and his brother kidnapped, tortured, and raped two young women in Malmö in Sweden, and they were convicted. I think the older brother was convicted and sentenced to 7 years in prison, and the younger brother to 4.5 years in prison. But then he, or probably his lawyer, appealed the decision, claiming that he was under the age of 18 when he committed the crime, so he shouldn't have been sentenced to prison. He was wrongfully sentenced. He should have been sentenced to something else instead. And eventually the Supreme Court of Sweden ruled in his favor. And now he's awarded almost 1 million Swedish kronor, which is basically 100,000 US dollars. So he's awarded $100,000 after having kidnapped, tortured, and raped two young women, keeping them at gunpoint, strangling them on a technicality. And he's still convicted for the crimes, and he should still have served a bunch of, he should still have served time. And this is what happens, right? I mean, this is what happens when these people come to our countries, but we have to go to Arab countries and Afghanistan and other countries, Muslim countries, to make sure that their women are looked after. I mean, none of this makes sense. It's completely insane. And there is this hierarchy of, there's this hierarchy of political correctness, and there's always the question of which group is at the top, right? So is it Jews? Is it gay people? Is it women and feminists? Or is it Arabs and Muslims? And when the interests of different groups in this value hierarchy in political correctness, when their interests clash, you just have to go with one instead of the other, right? You have to choose. Well, now it's in this situation, it's the Arabs that are more important. Well, in this situation, it's the women that are more important. In this situation, it's the Jews. In this situation, it's the homosexuals, right? So you have this hierarchy of victims. And it's a whole set of metaphysics in the modern worldview to sort of figure out how it all works and fits together.
Yeah, of course, it's white people, especially normal white people, who are at the very bottom. Their place doesn't change, but you know, the victim du jour is an interesting question. But there's no question that white people are being shuffled out, basically, of the future. Alexandra wrote in and sent a couple of donations, which I very much appreciate. One, she asked about the role of Jews in Mexico in promoting Mexican immigration from Mexico to the United States. It's a very wealthy, connected class of Jews in Mexico, and wonders if they would have any interest or angle there. I don't honestly know if they're involved, but I certainly know that a whole lot of Jewish organizations in America are quite openly promoting non-white immigration into the United States. I don't know if they're pushing, but they're from Mexico, but they're definitely pulling. The best description of why that's the case is Chapter 7 of The Culture of Critique by Kevin MacDonald. Alexander also writes in, and I want to get the opinions of Brody and Woz on this as well. She basically wonders if white men should start thinking about sperm banks and sperm donation. And I guess there are two things here. One is saving sperm for later, because God knows it's hard to find an appropriate mate in this world. And when one does, one doesn't want to be, say, over 50 or over 40, when the quality of one's sperm is declining and the chances of having, like, a defective child increase. And of course, the other thing is just, you know, it might be a way of having children, you know, simply by donation, which helps the white gene pool, right? I agree on both accounts. I think that people who are have high genetic quality should be donating sperm. Worried about finding a suitable mate should probably store some up. And just like women store eggs, it's less urgent for men than women, but there's still a correlation between age and genetic defects. And not even just blatant genetic defects, but I had a friend who for years and years was a Montessori's teacher, and she noticed over decades of teaching that the parents, that the children of older parents seemed just less vital less bright, less vital, smaller oftentimes than the children of younger parents. So there's some truth to that. And you want to give, if you're going to reproduce, you want to reproduce the best of yourself. And so that might, make sure that when you finally do find the right partner, that you can you can have the best possible children. That it's not too late. Now, another thing that we should do is just encourage people to donate if they have high genetic quality. Anyway, Woz, what are your thoughts on sperm banks and sperm donation?
Yeah, I would echo your thoughts on this. I think there's no reason not to do it, really. I think it's a good idea. We seem to be getting to a situation where men and women are no longer, for various reasons, and there are probably quite a few reasons, men and women are no longer as good as they used to be at getting together into couples and having the nuclear family. And that's a tragedy, but it is a reality. And I think one thing that people can do is, and this seems to be, I'm not saying that this is good. I want to emphasize that. I'm just saying it seems to be the way things are going, that there seems to be a sort of contractual culture emerging where people do things that are very specific and everyone knows what they're getting. Apart from anything else, it's the only way to stay safe, especially in the arena of sex, romance, reproduction. And, it's clinical, it's impersonal, it's not nice, but it seems to be the way that things are going. And in any case, even if you do have a normal marriage relationship and you have children, I think it's still a good idea to donate sperm because other people are not in that situation. So I think it's a reality. And I think if there are going to be these sperm banks, and if there are going to be these sperm banks, then it's probably preferable that the sperm is of good quality, and is European. Yeah. So, that's really all I would have to say about that. It's a sort of unfortunate subject to have to discuss, but it is a reality.
There's also another factor here, which is sort of privately arranged sperm donation. A friend of mine told me about an app that he joined called Just a Baby. And basically, the story seems to be this, that young women who go to college and get the good job and do the Sex and the City lifestyle and spend a lot of time on Tinder or whatever, after a while, they get into their 30s and they just can't seem to find the perfect guy. And so they get the Just a Baby app and think that they're going to get a perfect sperm donor. And a lot of it just becomes like weird, fetishistic romance stuff in its own way. It is a possible way of being a sperm donor and, sort of actually getting to know the person who would be mothering the child. So yeah, this is another option. Anyway, Frody, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think this is an interesting phenomenon. And just like, I've read politically correct people complaining that there's not a huge demand for porn with black women in the same way. In the same way I've read that the demand for sperm from sperm banks, sperm donors, has a very specific profile, ethnic profile. That is, women are very specific about what they want, and it tends to not match the politically correct notions about how things are supposed to be, because it seems that women who want sperm donors, they want it from white men. And it's funny that, with all the veneer of political correctness and bullshit, when it comes to reality, human nature shines through. And it's funny. So yeah, I do think that absolutely, even if you have a family, even if you have several kids, you should make use of that opportunity to have more children. So why not? I can right. generally not see any reason why not to do it.
Great. So Man of the North writes in over at Entropy with $15. Days like today, one wonders what an alternative future might have been if the U.S. and NATO hadn't spent trillions after the Cold War in foreign aid, neocon wars, and absorbing third world immigrants. Yeah, we'd have be broadcasting colony. We have wasted trillions of dollars. Think of the trillions of dollars of social uplift programs for Black people in America. All of that money's been wasted. And we could have been going to the stars, but we have been dragged back into the mud by bad plans, basically. Bad economics, bad science, bad values, bad priorities have really dragged us backwards. It's very sad. Frody, do you have any thoughts on this? The future that might have been if the U.S. and NATO hadn't spent trillions after the Cold War on foreign aid, neocon wars, and third world immigrants?
Well, yeah, I don't have any specific thoughts on that, but I mean, it just shows you what they want to support. I mean, it's they want to support globalism and. It's a meme that, you know, we could have done anything, but we chose to babysit Black people and babysit the planet instead. And this is what we have. I think the result is very predictable. And it's an unfortunate value system that we've been suffering under for decades and a century now.
Yeah. What about you, Woz? What do you think? Where would we be if we hadn't misspent trillions of dollars and God knows how many thousands or tens of thousands of lives when you're thinking about wars?
Well, it's not just that. It's also the effect that they have on our culture and the effect that they have on our solidarity, which then has secondary effects in our culture. So you know, their presence in mass numbers in our countries and which were formerly our countries is pretty negative for us. It tends to be pretty damn positive for them, but it's negative for us. And I, you know, in my more outspoken days, I used to pose the question, how have native Europeans benefited from the mass immigration into their countries of people from outside Europe? And no one could ever answer that question. No one could ever say how we benefit from it. So that's a thing. And as for where we would be without it, I've got a real thing for TV drama from yesteryear, specifically the 70s. And in that, you could watch pretty much any TV drama made in Britain in the 70s, and the entire cast is white. If occasionally 95%. But usually 100% of the cast is white, totally white. And it's really nice in this. And, you know, I can understand why, you know, Black people have complained that mainstream media doesn't represent them. They don't see Black heroes on the screen. They don't see Black women represented. Right wingers used to mock them for saying things like that. You know, 10, 20 years ago. Oh, why do you care so much about race? Why do you care about the color of people's skin? Just get into the drama. Just get into the action. Just enjoy the horror movie. Just enjoy the comedy. But that was always a stupid, tone-deaf, and rather autistic thing for conservatives to say. Typical of them. Just gormless. And the reality is that people do want to see themselves represented and their group represented on screen. So, well, now we are experiencing that. Now white people are experiencing what it's like when you don't see your group represented securely or favorably on screen. especially white men, you know, white male characters tend to be pricks. They tend to be jerks. And that's something that we would, you know, had we not gone this down this road, that is something that we would never have had to become familiar with. There are many other things that we would never have had to become familiar with, like what is a mosque? What is an Islamic priest called? What's the equivalent? It's the same with Hinduism, Sikhism, these various things. And then all this hate speech codes, the protocol, the behavioral protocols, stuff like microaggressions, structural violence, these concepts that we are drowned with now and which are used to berate us and paralyze us now, we would never have had to even know. We would never have heard the word microaggression. So we would just be in a much better condition in every way, really. I think we would still be suffering with modernity and mass production and you know, technology which dehumanizes and disconnects us from each other. There would still be the absence of the loss of religion. We would still have those problems to deal with, and possibly other cultural Marxist things like feminism, LGBT. But our lands would still belong to us, and we would still be secure in those lands. And we would still have those lands, not only as a guide from the past, but as a promise for the future. And so we would just be so much better off than we are. It's devastating what has been done to white people. And so, and that's not even counting the monetary cost, you know, the trillions that have gone into babysitting, especially black people, but also other races. And you can't help but wonder, we would be taxed less for sure. But that would be the least of it. You know, the taxation would be spent in other, better, more sensible ways, which directly benefited us, not other groups, other peoples. So it's just incalculable. You cannot work. You can't quantify in any way, really, monetarily or culturally or spiritually, how much better off we would be if we had not gone down this road. All you can hope is that people learn from this in the future.
That's very well said. Well, folks, we are running out of time and wrapping up. I just want to thank a couple people. Slog has donated 10 lemons, Alaska Chaga, one, because I can't thank them in person. We will be back next week. Woes, is there something coming up this week that you'd like people to know about?
Yeah, there's my regular Monday night stream on Telegram, which people can get to from the link tree that is provided here, or you can just go to Telegram and look for Millennial Woes. I'm there, or it's linked from my website, millennialwoes.com, and that will be happening at 10 p.m. British time tomorrow night. It happens every Monday at the same time, and then it goes up on my Odyssey a few days later. So that's where to find me.
Great. And Frody, you have a very big week coming up. You're going to be promoting the Great Debate, and then it'll be this coming Saturday. So how can people follow your activity? We are going to run something about this on Countercurrents this coming week. If folks want to help out in promoting this, how can they get in touch with you?
Yes, the best way is you can follow me on Telegram, Guide to Culture. That is Guide to KULCHUR, Guide to Culture on Telegram. And follow me there. The best way you can help me promote this is to share the links and make sure that everyone hears about this and finds out about this. Real_GTK on Twitter, you can share the post about the upcoming debate. And the debate is on Saturday, 21st at 4 p.m. American Eastern Time, 10 p.m. Central European Time. And if you are a live streamer on DLive, please help restream or what do you call it? Host it on your channel as well to get as many people as possible to watch this live. I think it will be very enjoyable. And yeah, help me promote it. That's the best thing you can do. And definitely get in touch. guide2culture@protonmail.com is my email. But yeah, follow me on Telegram. That's probably the best thing. And I also have an AMA coming up on Wednesday evening. So every Wednesday, I do an AMA on my channel. So those are the major things coming up this week. But of course, the big thing is the debate between Jared Taylor and E. Michael Jones next Saturday, the 21st. At 4 p.m. And I do appreciate help from everyone who helps me promote that event and make sure that as many people as possible will tune in and watch it live.
Great. And we will be, I'm sure, talking about it quite a lot next week on our next episode of Countercurrents Radio. So I want to thank you guys for coming. I want to thank our donors. I want to thank our moderators. I want to thank all of our great listeners out there. I especially want to thank Gadius and Nick Gilby in the chat. And we will be back next week with another episode of Countercurrents Radio.